Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to have back Mark Martinez. Mark, we talked to Mark a couple of years ago because he was working on a documentary about the golden age of bodybuilding during the 1970s. Mark started off with the idea of talking about the big parade that Ken Sprague put on to coincide with the 1977 Mr. America contest, AAU Mr. America, that was held in Santa Monica. And he had this huge parade featuring elephants and floats and all the stuff that goes into parades. And Bill Grant was part of it, Ken Waller, Dave Dupree, I believe, Tony Pearson, Rudy Hermosillo. So it was a really, really big event. It was a big event in Los Angeles or Santa Monica where they held it. So Mark started off doing a documentary about that, and then he decided to expand it and talk about the whole golden age of bodybuilding in the 1970s, particularly the Venice Beach area. So after 6 years of working on this and doing countless interviews and financing it basically himself, Mark has finally finished the project, and it's called Dream Big. And it will be released this fall. He's hoping to release it at the Venice Film Festival in Venice, California. So he is looking at, I believe, early October to have that. So I thought it would be great to bring Mark back on the show. I saw him on Dave Palumbo's show about a week ago. And we had a long discussion about bodybuilding in the golden age. So this will be part one of our interview with Mark. And we'll have, of course, part two next week. When I finish the interview with Mark, I'm going to read another article from Muscle Builder Magazine. And this one I thought was really great. This is the 1978 Mr. Olympia report that was featured in the February 1979 issue of Muscle Builder. So, of course, this covered Frank Zane's second Mr. Olympia. And it was written by Rick Wayne. And it's got a lot of stuff in there. He talks about Jimmy Caruso and Roy Callender and Robbie Robinson and, of course, Frank Zane. Ed Corney, Cal Scalak. This is the contest that Cal Scalak did his infamous crucifix pose. So a lot of inside stuff, as only Rick Wayne can do. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. It's kind of a long article. So stay tuned after our interview with Mark Martinez to listen to this article about the 1978 Mr. Olympia. They don't write them like this anymore, that's for sure. So I think you guys will really enjoy it. All right, before we get to all that, I do want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. And in the last week, of course, we had Arnold Schwarzenegger's birthday. Arnold turned 74 years old, if you can believe it, on July 30th. So happy birthday to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He is still healthy and happy and doing good. Arnold has a newsletter, if you guys are interested in it. I think you can just go to either Schwarzenegger.com and sign up for it, or go to updates@Schwarzenegger.com. And it's really cool. He's got a lot of stuff in it. He puts a lot of work into it. He talks about what's going on in his life. He talked about the Austrian summit that he just had in Austria. because his big passion in life right now is climate change, which I am fully behind that all the way. I think it's an important issue. So good for Arnold. But he also talked a lot about some of the bodybuilding stuff. He talked about Franco, kind of reminiscing about Franco. You could tell he misses Franco, and told some funny stories about Franco and his personality. And then he was talking about how he trained heavy, how he trained like a power lifter when he was in his prime. And every once in a while, like in the bench press, he would go down to like doing only 3 reps with the bench press. And he said the biggest bench press he had was 525. And in his training, he would handle like 455, 495 for 3 reps. So, man, Arnold was really strong. But it's really interesting stuff. If you're an Arnold fan like I am, I think you'll enjoy it. And in the links below of this podcast, I'm going to put an article I wrote about Arnold in 4 years ago when Arnold turned 70. So I wrote it on the bodybuildinglegendsshow.com website. So you can also just go to that. But I'll put the link right here in the description below. So check that out if you want to read a good article about Arnold that I wrote about 4 years ago. All right, out here in Tampa, we got the Tampa Pro coming up this weekend. So I'm looking forward to that. It'll be Friday and Saturday, August 6th and 7th, right out here in Tampa. It's actually right down the street from me, so it's very convenient. And it's one of the biggest pro shows of the year, so I'm excited to go to that. Sean Ray will be there, so I will be hanging out with him. I just wrote an article for Digital Muscle, which Sean is a part of, and it was about the history of the Tampa Pro. So I believe the show has been going on since 2008, and I covered every year, who won every year, and all the different divisions, well, the men's divisions at least, the bodybuilding, and then when the 212 started, and now also the classic physique. So I will also put the links to that article in the description below, so check that out if you're interested. It was a really interesting article. A lot of great guys won that show over, the last 13 years or so. And I'll be on Dave Palumbo's show next week talking about the Tampa Pro on his heavy muscle radio. So if you hear this podcast before that, you can check that out. All right. What else is going on? I got a couple emails I'm going to read in a second. And just been busy doing a lot of online coaching. So between my regular full-time job and doing the online coaching, it's been tough to get some interviews. So I was glad I got a two-part interview with Mark in last week, but I've got some other people that I'm going to be reaching out to soon. I got Linda Murray's information, so maybe we could talk to Linda Murray. I believe she was 7-time Miss Olympia, and she said she would be open to doing the show. And if you remember from our interviews with Jerry Branum, he was talking about a female bodybuilder named Janet Tech. Well, I guess Janet Tech liked the Bodybuilding Legends Instagram page that I have. And so I think she would be interested in being on the show because she seems like she's a big fan of our page, and I don't know if she's listening to the podcast yet, but if you are, hi, Janet, and I'll try to get Janet on the page because I know I want to get a lot more women bodybuilders. We only got Corey Everson, really, and then we talked to Ruth Silverman, so I was going to start a season of interviews about women bodybuilders, but I didn't get any, so hopefully we'll be able to get some of them up here because there's still a lot that I would love to talk to. So I hope you guys enjoyed those anniversary shows that we had on the last 3 weeks. It was fun putting all those together. And 4 years already, that's amazing, over 200 shows. So here's to year number 5. Hopefully we can get it going for another year. And I know I said this before, but thanks to all you people that support us on the Patreon page. I really appreciate all you guys giving your donations every month. It really means a lot to keep the show going. All right, let's read some of these emails. I got 2 emails last week. If you guys are interested in email me, of course, the email is naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. This one says, hi, John. I've been enjoying the anniversary shows. In the latest, Jerry Branum mentioned seeing legends at a Dan Lurie show. As history is written by the victors, Dan is omitted from much of bodybuilding history, though he did run the first ever IFBB show. I believe he was partner with Joe Weider to promote shows and manufacture equipment, but Joe decided to pursue those on his own very early on, and they broke apart. Another Weider defector, Sergio Oliva, had spectacular outings at Dan's WBBG shows. A possible show topic might be comparing Sergio from the WBBG Mr. Olympus wins in 1975, 76, and 78 to the Mr. Olympias of those years, debating if Sergio could have won those O's. A tough assignment, though, unless Jerry Branum happened to attend all of those, or you have a very good source for photos. I've also heard that Dan discovered Lou Ferrigno, but mentioning that might have Lou calling in to refute that one, like the Mihalik thing. I'd also like to recommend two guests in the form of Tony Atlas and Ivan Putski. Both have been interviewed in pro wrestling podcasts, but to my knowledge, never addressed their bodybuilding competitions. Tony was a three-time Mr. USA and inducted in the WBBG Hall of Fame, and Putski was Mr. Texas. Keep up the good work, John, as those of us enamored with the golden age of bodybuilding certainly love tuning in. Thanks, Dan Sen. Sounds like sensational if you end up reading this one. I did. Thank you, Dan. That's a great topic. I think Dan Laurie in general would be a great topic. Maybe we can get Randy Roach back on the show, because I know Randy wrote a lot about Dan Laurie in his books, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. So he might be a good reference point. And also Bill Grant. I know Bill competed in a lot of those WBBG shows. And did Tony Pearson? No, I don't think Tony Pearson did. But yeah, that would be a great topic, because those shows did kind of go under the radar. Of course, Dan Laurie covered them in his magazines, but it didn't get a lot of respect. And you're right. I think Dan was there with Joe Weider in the very beginning. He would definitely be an interesting person to talk about, for sure. So I think that's a great topic. So I'll try to put that together. So thank you for the email, and thank you for the suggestion. All right, this one I just got today. This is a great email I got. It's from Pete Miller. Now, I used to compete with Pete back in the 1980s. We competed in the 1990 MPC Illinois Cup contest. I won the light heavyweight class. Pete won the heavyweight class. He looked spectacular. We were the same height. He outweighed me by 20 pounds. He was 218 pounds at 5'8". Pete had some of the most spectacular leg development you've ever seen. He was way ahead of his time in that area. Upper body looked really good also. And in fact, Pete went on to win the AAU Mr. America, the 1990 AAU Mr. America, 2 weeks after that contest. So I've never heard from Pete. I heard he might have had some health problems. I didn't know what it was related to. So I haven't talked to him since, but I got a surprise email from him today. And he says, "Hey, John, I just want to send you a note of thanks for the great interviews you've done or are doing with the bodybuilding legends. I only recently became aware that you've done these. I heard and saw the interviews with Jeff King, Chris Dickerson, and a few others, a couple of whom I had not previously known about. I particularly enjoyed the interview with Mario Nieves, as I knew him halfway back in the day. Sergio as well. I've got a bunch more in the queue to see. Also, I appreciated the very kind words you made in reference to my physique during an interview John Torelli did with you. That was a pleasant trip down memory lane for me. By the way, you are and were absolutely correct that I hung up the trunks after the 90 Mr. America competition as a result of a pretty specific health-related matter. I was diagnosed with Epstein-Barr virus-related chronic fatigue. I did not have anywhere near the energy needed to train properly, and recovery, had I been able to train, was not possible. The good news is I eventually, over a period of a few years, recovered fully. I still love to lift the little weights. Of course, I was never strong even back in the day. Happy to wrap with you on that topic or related matters. Thanks again, and happy training, brother." Pete Miller. Yeah, maybe we can have Pete back on the show or on the podcast. He would be an interesting guest. Pete was, like I said, a great bodybuilder. Very little known, though, because his career, as he said, was cut short. But, man, this guy had spectacular leg development. Got a video on my YouTube page of the Illinois contest team, Illinois Cup contest. So check that out if you're on my YouTube page. But Pete also won the teenage MPC Illinois on the same day that I won the overall at the MPC Illinois Championships. Was a great bodybuilder back in the day and a very nice guy. He was showed me a lot of respect because I was a little bit older than him. So I always appreciated that, and I remember that. So I'm glad Pete is doing well, and it was great to hear from him. All right. Without further ado, guys, let's hear our interview with Mark Martinez, where he talks about his upcoming documentary project called Dream Big. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legend Show, and I have a very special guest with us this week, Mr. Mark Martinez. He is working on releasing his new documentary about Gold's Gym and the golden era of bodybuilding called Dream Big. Welcome to the show, Mark. Good to have you on here, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, John. I truly appreciate it.
Well, this has been a big work, hasn't it? I mean, I think we just saw your interview with Dave Palumbo not too long ago, like a week ago, and you started this in 2015, right?
Yeah, late 2015, and it's been a long haul. Part of it too, I think, was just securing guys to interview, because initially when I started, I got about five guys off the bat to interview, and a couple of others had said yes, but their schedules didn't work out. Manny Perry, it was more than a year and a half before we could actually connect, because he was actually in your home state, in your home city, in Chicago, because they were doing Empire at the time, and Manny, I believe, was a stunt head of stunt coordinating for that series that was on Fox. So he's like, "Yeah, it's like I'm in Chicago, and I'm unfortunately," he goes, "Well, good for me. I'll be there for however long the series runs."
Yeah.
But he was able to come back on a hiatus and hook up. But it's been a long a long process.
Yeah, I think the last time you were on my show was probably like 2 years ago, at least, right?
God, yeah, it was pre-COVID, and then that stops a lot of things too, you know.
Yeah.
All film festivals shut down.
Oh yeah, last year was like, I mean,
yeah,
I just went to a movie last week, and I think it was the first time I was at a theater in a year and a half. Well, since I think February of last year, since COVID started.
Well, what'd you go see?
Oh, I went to the Tampa Theater, which is this old theater. It's like almost 100 years old out here in Tampa. And I went and saw Jurassic Park, the original.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's right.
Classic movie series during the summer. So it was great.
Yeah, those are always fun.
And it was packed. So I think people are ready to get back to the theater, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. $10 popcorn or not, they want to get out.
Yeah, right. Well, Mark, let's start from the beginning on your idea for doing this movie. You know, you could talk a little bit about, you know, when you were younger and going to Gold's Gym. We just had our, I don't know if you heard it, we just had our 4-year anniversary show on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I included one of your clips where you were talking about the first time you went to Gold's Gym in 1977. And you knew Rudy Hermosillo's, I think, dad, right? And you met all these guys.
Yeah. I listened to part one, and I haven't gotten to part two yet on your season 4.
Yeah.
But thank you for including me. And, yeah, like I mentioned before on your show, seeing Rudy's picture in the magazine kind of spurred me on, because he was about a year and a half older than I was. And like I mentioned before, you know, we're both of, predominantly Mexican-American descent. So you immediately identify with someone who looks like you.
Yeah.
It was just so odd, because when I walked in that day, and there was Rudy, and there was his stepdad, Dino, and then Tony Pearson was in there, Bill Grant, Manny Perry, Larry Gordon. And like I said, too, the genesis of this actually started, I was listening to your interview with Bill Grant, and you and Bill were speaking, and Bill could not remember the name of his roommate, Larry Gordon. I remember just like, thinking, oh, that's Larry Gordon, you know, and that's really seriously what got me started. Like, I was there. I know some of the guys. I can contact guys by profession. I've been, cameraman and video editor and studio tech for close to 30 years.
Wow.
In broadcast TV. So I'm like, okay, I can shoot it and save a lot of money and just kind of like, cut it in between my free time, between raising a family and my real job, so to speak.
I didn't know that, Mark. So you have 30 years experience as a television and in the television industry.
Yeah. I started in Los Angeles. I went to school for that. And then of course, you know, and this is, middle 80s when I got out, and it's hard to get a job, you know, and in the industry, I was actually working for a food brokerage, selling Arrowhead water and Pringles potato chips. And I remember one day running into an old buddy of mine from grade school. Okay. And we must have been in the same restaurant, hadn't seen each other for years. And this is how it happens. He was working in the industry. And I said, well, I have my degree from there. I've been working at this other job for 9-10 months. And he goes, you have the experience. Come on in and you could start part-time or freelance or whatever. So that was like 1986. And it was a small TV station that way back in the day used to run like the Trans-Lux cartoons like Speed Racer and Amazing Three and Kip, you know, it was like on UHF TV.
Yeah.
And then from there I got a job at a station in Orange County. Then I worked for KCAL and NBC. And then I think in early 90s moved up to the Bay Area and worked at all the major networks up here.
Were you a big movie guy and a TV guy when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, loved movies and you're the same way. You're a film buff.
Yeah.
I know we've conversed via Facebook or email, and you know, like most people, you know, they'll like roll their eyes like, why do you want to go see Citizen Kane or Sunset Boulevard or Easy Rider or whatever movie, right? And you're just like, you know, for me, my very earliest memories, you know, sitting in theaters and film romanticized everything. I just loved the look of film and the music score and, you know, seeing the spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wow, how do they do that? Who gets to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, and it kind of put me on a long, arduous, truncated path. But yeah, like you know, loved film, loved movies, still do.
Yeah. So this is great now with releasing Dream Big, because you're putting together your two passions, bodybuilding and film.
Yeah. And it's that's true. And like they say, I remember years and years ago at work, and I'm at work at the TV station, but I'm not really doing what I really wanted to do. I'm in the field, but this one coworker, you know, she had said, you know, she says, they say, because she would do these personality tests all the time. And then she ended up actually leaving the station and becoming a voiceover artist.
Okay.
And we were talking one time and she said, they say that what you enjoyed and excelled at as a child, that's basically what you will excel at as an adult. Hmm. And I just remember drawing, making little 8mm movies with my friend Dave, who's actually scoring the movie for me.
Oh, cool.
Along with my brother. Yeah. And so it was a passion. And then, you know, like you know, you see a picture of, you know, it's probably Charles Bronson in a movie. Mm-hmm. And back then you think, wow, that guy's got a lot of muscles.
Yeah.
And, right. You know, you're thinking, wow. Or Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, you're picking up, weights in your bedroom and working out. It kind of took a long time for it to merge together.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's, I guess is the way it had to be. It wasn't the way I would have chosen if you told me it was going to take me how many ever years to get here, but it's, better late than never.
Yeah. So, it all started with the book Pumping Iron, right? Is that the first thing that got you into bodybuilding when you were young?
Yeah, it was. I think a little prior to that, I remember in the back of a comic book looking at those old Universal bodybuilding ads with Brian Eastman and another guy named Roy Parrott or Perot. And they were British bodybuilders, right?
Right.
I think NABBA guys. Yeah. And you're just like, oh my God. And then not long after that, when I was in freshman year in high school, and one of my buddies brought Pumping Iron, and I loved the photographs taken by George Butler.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the prose written by Charles Gaines. We've spoken about. Yeah, just an incredible writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I growing up in Southern California and looking at those photos, and I just said, I know how that looks, how that smells, you know, because I'm like, there they are down Pacific Avenue in Venice. You could smell the waffle cones and the cotton candy and the hot dogs and then it's mixed with the sea air. And a lot of people, I was talking to my friend Scott Murphy, who actually helped me with the Franco interview. He was my audio guy on that when we met with Franco a couple years ago. And he had said, you know, he goes, I just always assumed that those are, you know, they were all black and white photos in the book, right? And he goes, you know, when they're at the weight pit, I just assumed it was sunny. I said, if it was early morning, there's marine layer. I goes, probably kind of cool and foggy, and it would burn off. But
mm-hmm.
Those you know, when I was spending time with Charles in Alabama, I told him, I said, it took me all these years to realize I loved bodybuilding and I still enjoy working out. Today was one of those days I just could not get started. Then I went out in my garage and swung the kettlebells and did some burpees and then lifted some weights. And then it's like, oh my God, attitude adjustment. I felt so much better.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah. But I told him, I said, you know, I think it was the way you wrote about that world that made me, you know, just want to be in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic book.
Yeah, I know. I just, yesterday was Arnold's birthday.
Yeah.
So I wrote this, article for my Bodybuilding Legends website, probably, I think 4 years ago, cause it was Arnold's 70th birthday when I wrote this. Right. He's 74 now. And I ended the article with, paragraph from Charles Gaines, where he's talking about Arnold on stage at the 1973 Mr. Olympia. It's just so well written. This guy was a fantastic writer, you know?
Yeah, it is. Another thing that he mentions when Gaines writes about Arnold, and he's talking about moving through Gold's Gym and how he worked out, and he says, you know, it's hard work, you know, hoisting all this iron, and no one wants to be up early. And he goes, but he was... guys are grimacing and sweating and screaming. He goes, and Arnold, you know, just said he had a smile on his face. It was like everything he did.
Yeah.
He did with joy, you know? And I think that's why guys stay in shape lifelong, because they enjoyed it. Other guys, you know, they compete, guys you probably competed with or against, and they may have looked fantastic. And you see them 20 years later, like, oh, okay. You know, don't seem to work out anymore. And that's cool. Everyone can do what they want. But I think the people that really love it and enjoy it, you know, have to keep doing it at some level.
Yeah. It's amazing. When I think back to like the guys I competed with when I was a teenager or even in my 20s, a lot of them now aren't training at all anymore, you know?
Yeah.
You know, one part of the book I really loved too, talking about Charles Gaines, was he was talking about when he was working out with Joe Disco. And
yes.
He said there was one part where they left the gym and they were walking down the sidewalk and how they felt, how exhilarated they felt. And then smelling the air, and then the hot dog stand was down the street or something, and they were smelling that, and they just said he felt like top of the world, you know what I mean? And that's I just so can resonate with, you know, because I've been working out for over 40 years, and that is how you feel when you're done having a good workout, you know.
Oh yeah, I remember that, like the first time you got a pump.
Yeah,
you know, and then it was just so cool. And when I flew to Alabama and Charles put me up for a little over 3 days. And it was just fantastic. You know, he's got this wonderful compound on a lake.
What part of Alabama was he in, Mark?
He's outside of Birmingham is the major city.
Right.
But he's a few miles north of that. And it's actually a small town called Argo.
Okay.
But it was kind of cool because when you would, you know, he would get in his SUV with his four dogs in the back and we would go into town and everyone knew who he was.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, but when I was leaving after my time there and I'm going to go back to the airport. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go downtown Birmingham to where they filmed Stay Hungry. And Charles told me we were actually, I think the first day I was there, we went downtown. He had to pick some stuff up.
Okay.
And he showed me where the gym, where Magic City Gym used to be on second, it was oddly enough on Second Street in downtown Birmingham. So before I left for the airport, I went back and you know, walked down those streets. Like this is where Charles and Joe Disco and all those other guys must've walked after eating Chinese food and working out and feeling, as he called it, sinfully clean, right? After the shower.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yes.
So take me back, Mark, to when you were younger, and you can even tell that story again about going to Gold's Gym for the first time. So you guys read Pumping Iron when you were like middle school, right?
No, I was a freshman in high school.
Oh, freshman.
And okay. Yeah, I was a freshman in high school, and just reading it, looking at the photos of it.
Did you start working out after that?
You know, I did, and it was weird because I did not have the book. My friend did.
Okay.
And but I remember, like, you know, borrowing it, reading it. And then started lifting. You know, I wrestled my freshman year, and it's like, wow, I'm gonna have to get stronger here. And so, you know, you start. You know, my mom's cousin had a weight set. It's an iron weight set. It was about, I don't know, 115, 120 pounds. So he let me have it. I'm out in the garage next to the washer and dryer, you know, working out and then going to the weight room at school. So that was kind of, and then I think, you know, because I was lanky and then I put on some weight. So my freshman year, I think I went from like 120 pounds to like about 136.
Okay.
And then by the end of my freshman year or early sophomore year, I weighed 165. So,
wow.
Yeah. But the thing was, I think, I mean, I'm not a tall guy. I'm like, you know, 5'11" on my best day, but I think it kind of satisfied me for a while. Cause I'm like, okay, I feel normal. I feel, like I fit in now. I'm not so lanky, you know, I'm not a bone rack anymore. And then I kind of like did it begrudgingly only because of sports. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was after high school, it's like, oh, you know, everything's kind of over in terms of any sort of competitive activity sports wise at all. Right. So I think that's when I think it was my senior year, right after football season. And I'm like, started looking at the magazines again, bought my own copy of Pumping Iron, and then it really reignited me. And then that's when I drove out to Goals like a few months later.
So after high school, then that's when you went out to Gold.
Well, I was still in high school when I went.
Senior year, okay.
Yeah. It was early in my senior year.
Where did you grow up, Mark?
How close? So I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, which is probably about 25 to 28 miles from Santa Monica. If you take the 10 straight.
Okay.
Straight through. So yeah, I grew up in, I was raised in actually the town that In-N-Out originated.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So it's called Baldwin Park. And the original In-N-Out was there. The Snyder family still owned a meat market in town. Back in those days, there was probably maybe 10 In-N-Outs and they were all located in the surrounding cities in the San Gabriel Valley. They weren't even in the San Fernando Valley yet. They weren't on the West Side. They weren't in the South Bay. It's kind of funny now to think that it's this huge phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, you grow up, you know, you're born and raised in Los Angeles and you're just like, well, you have a car and you drive everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, people didn't, you know, it's, and we never, you know, since I moved to Northern California, they go, I know you're from Los Angeles by two things. The way you say freeways in Southern California will say, I went on the 405 or the 10. And if you're in Northern California, you say, I took 680 and 5. They don't say the, and we say the. Oh. And then we talk in minutes. We don't talk in miles. It's like, that's about 40 minutes. It's not 25 miles. It's four, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, peculiarities. I'm sure you have some from Chicago or even in Florida.
Yeah. So did you follow bodybuilding when you were in high school?
I did, all of a sudden, it's funny because I think of other instances and I think it may have been my junior year, most likely my senior year. And one of my classes was study hall. Cause you know, by then you have pretty much all your credits and, it was a Catholic school. So they didn't let you graduate early. You had to put in the time. So it's like, okay, well, great. Well, I go to the rectory for one period and help Sister Mary Michael file index cards. And then another period I get to sit in the library and read. So I remember there was one, Arnold was on the cover, but it wasn't a bodybuilding magazine. It was like a general market magazine, like a Psychology Today or something. But I remember he was on the cover and it said, is all this muscle really healthy? And there was photos inside. And I'm like,
I remember that magazine. It was
a brown cover, I believe.
Psychology magazine, like you said.
Exactly. And I'm like flipping through it. And I don't know if it was that magazine or another one, but in the middle of it was this ad and they're selling like, you know, whatever, sports equipment, protein powder, sports equipment, whatever. And in dead center of it was an ad that had like a shot of Bill Grant with a cambered curling bar. And it says, you know, 1972 Mr. America, Bill Grant. And I remember just looking at it and just going, holy cow, you know, cause it just, you know, looked like he was like pressed in a mold and you're just like, wow, you know, I guess this is calling to me, you know, somehow, some way.
Yeah.
So yeah, that kind of, you know, got me fired up. And then one of my buddies, he was being recruited by University of Washington. He was one of the kids that was just a beast. He was benching 315 for reps as a freshman, just a monster.
Yeah.
And I remember we're the ones that went the first time, and he saw all the guys, you know, all, you know, when we walk in and
Were you ever, do you ever think about competing, Mark, when you were in high school and teenage?
Well, you know, I did compete, but I didn't compete. I never placed. I competed in a teenage show, and then I competed in 84 and 85 in a novice show.
Okay.
And and it was funny because that last show, you know, I was trying to finish school. I was kind of like at that point, maybe at the end of my initial love of bodybuilding, like I just have to move on to other things in my life. And I remember over dieting, and I just remember, you know, I'm like, oh my God, I lost all this weight to get cut, but I'm like, but I lost a lot of muscle with it. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to get the show over with, and I did. And funny thing was, about 3 weeks after that, I go with some friends from the gym, and one guy's competing in a smaller regional contest. And Kent Keene is the expediter there. And I hadn't seen Kent in a couple years. He was one of the managers of the Golds on Second Street. Mm-hmm. And he goes, are you going to compete tonight? I said, no. And he goes, oh, you look really good. I mean, I had a shirt on, but I'm like, yeah, I wasn't even working out that much the 2 or 3 weeks post contest. And I was just eating normal, but I'm like, wow, it showed me how much I was depleted and over dieted by the fact that if I just ate normal, I filled out, you know, which is, it's probably something you dialed in after like one or two contests, you figure it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was it for me. I hung up the posing trunks.
Okay. So you guys went to Gold's Gym. That was 77 then, right? When you decided.
Yeah.
So you never went to the other one that was in Venice, right?
No, you know, that was the thing, is it was already turned into Ken Sprague's home.
Oh, okay.
And that was the thing, because we drove there first.
Because they moved in 77, right?
Was
it
in 77? Yeah. And I think they may have moved it in late 76, but you may be right. If Ken told you 77.
No, you might be right. I think it was right after they filmed Pumping Iron, right? Isn't that when they moved it? Yeah.
Yeah, right. And then, yeah, it's again, like, you know, we mentioned in the previous interview, a lot of people don't realize that by the time Pumping Iron hit the theater,
it was already
the original Golds. Yeah, it was already a house.
Wow.
I know. I really wish, because, you know, being out on the West Side, you know, going to Santa Monica or Venice when you're hanging out as a teenager, and it's like, since it wasn't on my radar, not looking. You know, I probably was around the corner from it a couple times and not even focused on it.
Yeah.
You know,
crazy.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit again about that story when you guys walk in the Gold's Gym in 1977, and what prompted that? Did you know Rudy Hermosillo's dad before that, or?
No. I met them there, and it was, I remember reading, I think Mike Mentzer wrote the article in the Muscle Builder. I believe it could have been someone else.
Okay.
But there was a picture of Rudy, and I think he had just won the Teenage USA. So he's still like a little over a year away from winning the Teenage Mr. America.
Okay.
Because it said in the photo, like, he was barely 18 years old at the time that photo was taken. And I looked at the development like, holy cow. Mm-hmm. So my buddy and I drove out there, and it was almost, you know, if I had a better contact with my inner self, and realizing when you take leaps or when you take chances, you can manifest things in your life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like, it's like I walked in, there's Dino, there's Rudy, there's all these guys, and I'm like, this is almost too easy. This is great. Mm-hmm. And I think because I was young and my friend was young, and Dino could see that we were interested.
Yeah.
You know. And he kind of like smiled and nodded his head. And then after Rudy finished, you know, he walked over to us and we were talking, and, are you guys interested? You know, so it kind of started like that. I mean, it was like,
they just let you walk into the gym.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I remember walking in, And there had to have been Pete Samra at the desk, or maybe Kent, but or maybe no one. Maybe they were folding T-shirts in the back or something. Yeah. And I just looked. Yeah. When you walk through that door, to the left was the desk, the front desk. And then to the right were like rack of dumbbells and some mirrors. And Rudy was over there doing lateral raises for his shoulder. Tony Pearson was over there as well. And I think behind them, I remember Larry Gordon was. And then I look over to the left and there's like Bill Grant and then Manny Perry. And you're just like, wow, I've seen all these guys in the magazines. And then so I think Richard Baldwin was there. I mean, it was summer. So a lot of guys, it wasn't summer. That was in 78, but there had to have been some, they were probably getting ready for a contest.
Yeah.
But I was just like, oh my God, like every guy in here, you know, and then you start to think like, what am I doing here? You know, what the hell was I thinking?
You know? How big of a gym was it, Mark?
It wasn't very big. You know, John Balick had said, I mean, I was in there, and of course at the time when you're like 17, you don't think in terms of square footage.
Right.
But, I think both John and Ken owned it. But he said, I think it was like 5,100 or 5,500 square feet, which, and that was bigger than the original. The original one was less than that. And, and it was, kind of like a shotgun building in the sense that it was in a row of businesses on Second Street.
Okay.
And it used to be an automotive repair garage way back in the day. But it was a wonderful building because it had the brick walls, exposed brick on the walls, nice skylights overhead. And then the alleyway in the back was that huge industrial type door for garages where they would have to roll up the back door with the chain.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. That thing would be rolled up and then the ocean breeze would come in, off the coast. And it was just, I know Ken had said it because, it was kind of an old building and it was kind of, funky and I said, a lot of people thought it was heaven, because of the temperature and the atmosphere.
Yeah. Did you see like any of the pros like Robbie or Metzer or Samira that day?
Yeah. Not that day. And I did not see Robbie that day, but I remember coming back probably like a couple weeks later and Robbie's working out. And of course, this is the time when, Franco had retired, Arnold had retired and Robbie was the heir apparent. Right.
The man. Yeah.
Right. There are a few things that really, really make impressions on you. And Robbie, just every fiber in his body was just in bold relief under his skin. Mm-hmm. And very quiet. He was training with a guy named Denny Malloy.
Right.
And Denny was a big guy. He was like 6'1", 6'2", went like 240, and Robbie's like 5'8". Mm-hmm. But, and Robbie trained with relatively heavy weight and a lot of reps, which I remember. I'm like, he was doing 20 reps on decline. He was really high rep skiing. And I don't know if he trained that way all the time, but the first time I saw him, that was the first thing that shocked me. It's like, wow, that's pretty heavy weight. And he's doing a lot of reps.
Wow.
But yeah, just, and quiet and intimidating, because he had those funky, t-shirt tank tops that looked like they're barely hanging by a thread.
Yeah.
The beanie on,
Probably just a real serious demeanor, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. That's awesome. I'm surprised he was training high reps with heavy weight. That's interesting to hear. That's probably why he was, so hard looking and ripped,
Yeah. Oh yeah. And who knows? I mean, may have been heavyweight to me, but to him, probably not.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking it's like still when you're doing like 85 or 90 pound dumbbells for incline flies for high reps.
Yeah.
That's a lot of energy. Yeah.
I've always read that Robbie was strong. He trained with heavyweights,
Yeah. 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 Squatting and deadlifting. And yeah, he was, he was kind of like the perfect height for a power lifter, Olympic lifter,
That was at 78. You saw that?
That was 77.
Oh, 77. Okay.
Yeah, because
he was in training for the Olympia that year.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's right. It may have been, yeah, because it would have to have been in the fall, or maybe he was training for the 78. If this, I'm trying to think if the 77 had already happened, because it would always happen in the fall, right?
Yeah, it was October 1st that year, 77.
Right, that's right, that's right. And then Zane won his second. Yeah, now I'm like, I'm sounding like, you know, I can't remember. But yeah, Robbie, I think, made one of the hugest impressions on me because his condition was just, you know, yeah. to this day, I mean, the waist to shoulder differential.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was almost cartoon like. It was, you know, like his waist must've looked like it was 25 inches.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Big lats.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Did you get a chance to see Mensur?
Yeah. And then Mike, he was, I think they said he came out for a short time in 77 and then set up full time in 78.
Yeah.
And he was there. Yeah. Mike was there, and he was friends with Rudy and Dino. And in fact, the program that Dino and Rudy had suggested was a push pull split.
Okay.
2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, 2 days off. And they go, this is how Mensur trains.
Okay.
And it was, basically, you know, probably three exercises per body part, about four to five sets each.
Okay.
Mike was, again, I mean, I remember like looking at his forearms, you know, and they were like the size of my thigh at that time. You know, he was just, you know, and incredibly strong.
What was he training? Do you remember?
I do remember that he was, when I recall, he was training for, it was the Gold's Classic in 78.
Right.
I recall seeing him all the time. And so that was the, he was in the amateur part, and then he also entered the professional part, right? And I think Robbie won the professional, but Mike, it was the USA versus the world, and Danny won that. Danny. And I think Bronston Austin actually won the medium, and Mike won the, I guess, taller heavyweight. I'm trying to think about, because, you know, Bronston Austin at the time was not getting a whole lot of publicity.
No.
Platts was obviously, because he was out of Golds, he was getting a lot of publicity and in the magazines, but Bronston Austin was just balanced and ripped. And
He was from Illinois. He was from
Miami. Yeah, that's
right.
Great competitor. Very nice man.
Yeah. I think it took a couple more years before he was really noticed, 1980, I think.
That's right. He represented in the U.S., right?
For the
World Championship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great bodybuilder.
Johnny Fuller in the universe.
That's right.
Yeah. 1980. Yeah. Do you remember what Mensur was training that day? Like what body parts?
Well, I saw him train, I was there a lot of the time, and I remember seeing him on the Nautilus pullover machine.
Okay.
And it was the plate loaded. It was the early. And in fact, right. I think that was Franco's machine that Arthur Jones had given him. And Franco just left it at the gym. I don't think a whole lot of guys used it, but Mike did, you know, and, you know, he did that. He was doing,
did he train like all out intensity, like he said he did?
Yeah, you know, I remember one time looking when he was doing the pullovers, and I'm like, wow, his rep scheme, his reps were very, very slow.
Okay.
On that pullover machine, and you could just see him pouring sweat, and he's quiet.
Yeah.
And then he would move, and then they had a lat pull down machine kind of close to where the pullover was, and he had the entire stack on that, and I think he had like some plates hanging off it.
Wow.
you know, like they kind of jerry rigged it, you know. It's like, wow, this guy's strong.
Yeah. Was he supersetting the two?
He was. Okay. He was with that. So that was
over to lat pull downs. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember seeing him when he was doing pec deck, and he didn't superset it with the inclines that day anyway. I mean he may have, but again, you know, extra weight hanging off the machine. And super, super slow reps. And then he had his training partner, and it wasn't Rain. It wasn't Casey yet. It was a taller guy, but they would really like squeeze out the contraction part of it.
Yeah.
And then Mike would fight it back, you know, and I don't think anyone was really training like that other than Mike at that, that I recall. It was so different.
Yeah. That's cool. You got to see that in person.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, and it's funny because I mean, at the time you're not even thinking about it, and it's not till decades later when people are talking about it on the internet, you're like, oh wow. You know,
right.
It's kind of lucky.
Yeah. So did you start training there on a regular basis?
Yeah. I remember, I would go out there when I could on weekends. And then after I graduated from high school, my senior year before I started college, I joined and bought a membership. So then, you know, that summer, 77, it turned into 78. And that's when I went to the Gold's Classic at the Shrine.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. And Rudy won the Teenage USA. Robbie won the Pro or Teenage America. Sylvester Stallone had come out on stage.
Right.
You know, and at that time, obviously he was probably the largest box office star in the world or one of them.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know, Ken had mentioned just the, he knew how valuable it was to have a photo of an A-lister Hollywood guy handing out a trophy.
Yeah.
At, you know, because it was, you know, I couldn't have bought that promotion, you know, from a PR firm, you know, for my gym or my contest. Yeah.
He had the white suit on, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was all white suit. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. How was the crowds back then, Mark? Was it a good crowd and pretty boisterous, pretty loud?
It was, you know, and it was a, you know, a different time. I haven't been to a bodybuilding show in decades. And I think you may have mentioned this with Joe, Fulco, Joey.
Yeah.
And I was talking to him on the phone one time because his daughter had entered a competition a few years back. And he said, I just couldn't believe that. The lighting was so bad. It was very, very stark. So you couldn't really see the physiques. Everyone's washed out. The background is nothing but ads.
Yeah.
You know, and he goes, it was just a different feel. I said, you know, I can't speak to that because I haven't been, but it sounded like, he goes, they don't put any emphasis on posing. They don't give anyone their time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the crowds back then, I think, you know, since Ken did the 77 Mr. America the prior year and then the Mr. California, I think the year prior to that, he had been building. He was very, very smart because his connections went outside of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
So, you know, he could, you know, have, you know, call the promotions producers at all three major networks in Los Angeles and get people out there and get them out there, you know, a month or two before the contest. And then they would record the TV packages that would air on the evening news. And then, you know, obviously had the hardcore fans, but I think you had a lot of people that were like, oh, maybe I'll go check that out.
Yeah.
You know,
when bodybuilding was just getting into the mainstream media.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the general public.
Right. Exactly. It was still a curiosity. And I think, you know, and he was very smart in priming the pump. In terms of that, because I think the Shrine seated 5,000 people, and it was close to packed.
Wow, I'm kidding.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, it was, and I think too, another thing aside from Stallone being there, you know, Ken had connections to Hollywood, so he would have writers from the Hollywood Reporter magazine or local TV people, and he'd probably comp them. Come on and sure. You know, give you a seat, you know, because and because the publicity carried on.
It's weird you don't see that anymore, Mark. You know, now in today's world, it's like they don't really, the people that are running even the big shows, they don't really care about getting publicity for the contest. It's just the bodybuilding community and that's it. You know, they don't reach out to TV stations, newspapers are kind of dying out, but they don't reach out to the main media, you know, the mass media.
Yeah, it is odd because you think you'd want to build some sort of buzz, at least out of curiosity.
Yeah.
But maybe they don't know. And then
or even just to promote the sport, you know, out to the world, you know.
Yeah, I agree because you know, I've been told, I think you've mentioned that most of the audiences now are just made up of friends and family members of competitors. And it's never going to grow beyond that.
No.
If you can't reach, you know, beyond that.
When I was promoting natural shows in Chicago, I would always, like, there was a guy from, what was his name? Elliot. And he wrote the sports for the Chicago Sun-Times. And I would contact him. And he did show up a couple times. And then he would put it in the paper. He liked the girls. You know, he liked the bikini.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So he would take pictures with them. But he put them, I remember a few times we got in the Sun-Times with that. And I would call up the TV stations. And I don't think they ever showed up. But I called them, you know.
Yeah.
I would call the local papers. And we had stories done there. So I was always trying to do that, too. But it's amazing that, like, the bigger shows, you know, the pro contest, the Mr. Olympia and stuff, they don't really reach out to the mass media, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's a different world too with the internet. I mean, you know,
totally different.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
People under a certain age view YouTube as TV, and it is. I was driving the other day, and I heard they said the amount of the billions of dollars that YouTube has produced revenue wise, and I was shocked at the amount in terms of, like, the stuff that they have streaming on. They're not just the little crazy videos that people post, but, like, stuff, content that people post. And I'm like, there's not a network today, be it NBC, CBS, ABC, or Fox, that wouldn't love to have the billions of dollars that YouTube. And I said, well, yeah, if in terms of revenue of ad dollars booked is the mark of a network, then yeah, YouTube is, it's probably the biggest network. It dwarfs mainstream now, you know? And
I was just watching, Bob Costas has a new show on HBO, and I was just watching it today. And they had this girl on, and she's a reporter, a sports reporter. And she was talking about how younger people interpret the mass media or the social media today.
Right.
And they did this survey, and they asked these athletes, they said, these young athletes, if you could win this competition or get 20,000 new viewers on your YouTube channel, which one would you choose? They had to think about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Because it was, like, almost more important to get the 20,000 new viewers on your YouTube than it was to win the competition. And these are athletes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you've seen it. You've seen it in Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, where you don't even have to be a competitor anymore, right? You could just be a guy or a girl
in that personality. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And exactly. You're like, hey, you know, I'll sell you my training program, and they're making money, you know, whereas back in the day, if the competitors, if they didn't win a contest, they would make their money by probably being personal trainers, if that's what they wanted to stay in.
Yeah.
And I know there was a few guys at Gold's and then later on at Worlds that became kind of like the first generation of celebrity trainers.
Mm-hmm. That's what, you know,
and yeah. And that was how they made their money, versus now. Yeah. You could be anybody on Instagram. And if you have a great body, you're an expert, and you're selling your supplements or your courses or your whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring another episode of this podcast. Thank you again to all our Patreon sponsors, all you guys who donate cash to the show every month. I really, really appreciate it. And if you're interested in supporting the show and becoming a Patreon sponsor yourself, you can just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link. And I also have those links listed below in the description of the podcast. All right. So I don't know if you guys are enjoying these articles as much as I am, but I absolutely love them. These old muscle builder articles are absolute gold. This was the 1978 contest report written by Rick Wayne. I think you're really going to love it. Here we go. The headline says, "Zane again, but Robbie cries all the way to the bank," by Rick Wayne. Is it crucifixion when a man nails himself to a cross, or just plain suicide? Is somebody up there pulling the strings labeled Zane? Is Robinson more interested in his bank account than the Olympia title? What gives with calendar? Should Corny be spending less time on posing and more on muscle building? Does Grant have to be so damn consistent? The Big O offers a maze of rhetorical questions with positively dangerous answers. And it's got a great picture of Frank Zane doing a hands-on hip, most muscular, looking absolutely shredded.
And it says Frank Zane managed to exceed even his winning 1977 Mr. Olympia form. From the earliest moments of the prejudging, he was a standout. All right. Funny how Danny Padilla kept talking about the next Mr. Olympia aboard the Big O. Special, as if indeed the 1978 contest had already been held and decided. I'm going to be so ripped, he said over and over to Roger Callard. Nobody's going to believe it when they see me. Already I'm developing a new split in my calves. Then Padilla went into a long nostalgic account of the first time he saw Sergio Oliva at New York's Brooklyn Academy of Music. I guess I must have been about 12 or 13 at the time, said the sometime giant killer to Joe Weider and Roger Callard while I feigned asleep. I saw the man with my own eyes, but even after all these years, I still can't believe I saw what I saw. Sergio was incredible. He put his arms up and they looked like, honest, like the pillars of some Roman temple. The man couldn't pose. I mean, he put his left leg here and his right over there, and he held his head down so when it should have been up. And for anyone else, it would have been a shit awkward pose. But overall, when Sergio did his thing, that's what it always was, his thing. The man was unbeatable. Now Danny rolled those sweet, innocent eyes, those eyes that set hundreds of maternal hearts pumping pure milk at his various appearances. Yes, Danny rolled his eyes like Muhammad Ali at a press conference. The voice that came out of the Puerto Rican was also straight Ali. Look, he said, the man was the greatest of all time. For me, anyway. Even Arnold must know that deep down inside his chest. Joe Weider winced. Believe it, Roger Callard piped in. Wouldn't it be hell if Sergio surprised everyone and showed up in Columbus? Yeah, I said in my head, behind half-closed, lying eyes. Callard went on. I first experienced Oliva when he gave an exhibition at Michigan State. I was a student there. Sergio pumped up with 350 pounds on the bar. He did 50 reps. In what exercise, Joe wanted to know. Squats? Bench press, Roger corrected him coldly. So now it was my turn with the Sergio tale. Back in 65, I said, the rumor was that Sergio would be competing in that year's IFBB Mr. Universe. It would have been his first IFBB appearance, of course. By that time, Sergio had already established quite a reputation. Even though guys like Jerry Daniels and other similar nondescripts had been handed AAU honors over him. Well, anyway, the Universe prejudging began and ended, and there was no sign of Oliva. So I turned to Joe Weider and said, what happened, Joe? Why didn't Sergio show up? Joe shrugged his shoulder pads. Who the hell cares? We'll have a great show anyway. Besides, the guy's waist is too small. Everyone broke up over that one. Everyone except Joe Weider. So then I hastened to say, of course, Joe didn't really mean what he said to me. It's just that when he's really disappointed, he comes out with remarks like that. You ought to hear what he says about Dave Draper when Joe interrupted me. I never said a thing like that about Sergio. But anyway, do you know what Lady Vanderbilt said about women? She said there are two things they can't have too much of. They can never be too rich or too skinny. That's what she said. But on to Columbus. Oscar State, the IFBB's chief judge, was waiting at the airport. Unfortunately, he bumped into Bill Grant in the baggage claim area. How you doing, Billy? Said the Englishman in surprisingly American tones. Oh, I'm doing just fine, Grant replied. And I hope this year you're not going to ask me about my calves in front of the Olympia judges as you did last time. I've been meaning to talk to you about that, Bill, Oscar said good-naturedly. I read that statement of yours in Muscle Builder, but put it down to Rick Wayne being Rick Wayne. I thought Rick had invented it just for effect. Evidently he didn't. You actually said that? Betcha. Well, I don't recall asking about your calves at the Olympia. And even if I did, I certainly would not have done so in the presence of the judges. But you did. You know I didn't. Oh, yes, you did. No, I didn't. They were beginning to look and sound like the scene from Annie Oakley, the one with Howard Keel and what's-her-name. When Jim Lorimer, co-promoter of the Olympia, arrived, the smile on his face seemed to set Bill Grant's blood to boiling point. I want a word with you, Jim, said Bill, most unaffably. Sure, said Lorimer. What's the problem, Bill? I want to know why my ticket was not made out to Kathy. Kathy who? Is there a Kathy in the Olympia? Or the international? I particularly asked Arnold to make my ticket out to my girlfriend, Kathy, but he didn't, and I had all kinds of hassles at LAX. And another thing, why am I being treated as if I'm a nobody? I mean, I'm a professional, and I deserve better treatment. Meaning? Asked Lorimer, obviously as confused as the lookers-on. Meaning I never received instructions regarding my hotel accommodation or anything. Well, that's strange. You were sent your instructions in the mail like everyone else. I never got them. Sure you did. No, I didn't. Oh, yes, you did. That Howard Keel scene again. Are you calling me a liar? I'm saying we sent the whole package with your instructions concerning contests and hotel arrangements to the address you gave us. It did not come back, so you must have received it. Just then, thankfully, Grant's luggage appeared on the conveyor belt, and he strutted off to pick up the two suitcases. Lorimer moved into the crowd to advise the various overambition muscle men on the matter of transportation to their hotels. The Sheridan lobby. Here it's like Weider offices at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Wall-to-wall muscle, quaintly designed muscle t-shirts everywhere, pumping iron paraphernalia, and aptly attired busty girls doing a roaring trade. It would be interesting to discover exactly how much bread the Olympia generates. I'm standing at the Sheridan's reception desk with Dennis Tenorino and Tony Pandolfo and a bunch of muscle-bound strangers in Roger Callar t-shirts, worried to death that what ace photographer Joe Valdez has told me is valid. If Joe's correct and the place has been overbooked, then where in the name of muscle builder will I rest my weary self this night? I'm standing there hating the world when I feel someone tugging at my left shirt sleeve. It turns out to be Jimmy Caruso, super lensman from Montreal and mentor of Roy Callender. I'm afraid, Jimmy says when I turn around. Can't get a room? No, not that. I'm on the second floor. I got in early. But I'm afraid, Rick. Under normal conditions, Jimmy wears a face that reminds of mass funerals and things not usually associated with great joy. Right now, however, he's gone the whole hog, and his face appears to be hanging mere inches from his shoe buckles. I mean, skinny Jimmy has jowls like a forlorn bulldog. What are you afraid of, I say, for a minute forgetting my own predicament and what Valdez earlier assured me is the case at the Sheridan? Someone steal your camera, Jimmy? You got trouble? So then Jimmy recites a labira about Callender's training habits, which, according to Jimmy, has nothing to do with training. The guy just hates to work out, says Caruso. I did everything, but no way. I'm afraid, I tell you. Don't tell me Roy's chickened out. Well, no, he hasn't, but I'm afraid. Is he here? Not yet, but he'll be here in a few minutes. He just didn't get together, Rick. Why not? It's hell to get him to train, and he won't stick to a diet. I did all I could, but you're afraid, I know. The desk clerk had found me a room, but for one night only. See you later, Jimmy, I said. On my way to the elevator, I bumped into Callender, all done up in gray suit and tie, looking for all the world like an animated showroom dummy in a Macy's store window. I mean, unconcerned, expressionless. Hi, Roy, I say. What's all that stuff Jimmy's been hitting on me? What's he been saying? Never mind about that. But tell me, are you in shape? Yeah, but not as good as I'd anticipated. Meaning? Exactly what I said. Are you better than you were for the World Cup? Well, sure, but that's not good enough. Could get it together. What he said was good enough for me. Besides, Roy's the kind of guy who cries at victories the way most people carry on at funerals. You don't go to people like that looking for good news and glad tidings. It was characteristic of him to say that while he was in better shape than the amazing condition he offered earlier in Los Angeles, he was not quite good enough for the big Olympia. Nuts. What a contrast to Cal Scalak, who would tell me sometime before the Olympia prejudging that there isn't a line on Zane's body that I can't match. I'm ripped for this one. I shall spare you the details of that trip with Leroy Colbert, one of the judges, and the George Schneider family when we went in search of a place that Leroy had been told offered fantastic food. Finally, we settled for a restaurant mere yards from the Sheridan after Leroy and his attractive wife Jackie had driven us all over Columbus and maybe Paris too, for all I know, against our will. Leroy, who would be one of two black judges on the Mr. Olympia panel that day, was talkative during dinner, as always. And, fool that I am, I had to encourage him. This time we went into a matter of Leroy's article that appeared some months ago in Muscle Builder. "Who says Mr. Olympia has to be black?" he had titled the piece, as if someone had told him Mr. Olympia had to be white or green or blue. Well, now I was telling him how I tried to get Robbie Robinson's reaction to the aforementioned published feature without success. Repeatedly, Robbie had merely looked at me with eyes that screamed, "No comment." In due course, he would talk, however, but wait. "Man, that Robbie, where's he coming from?" said Leroy in his boisterous, inimitable fashion. who does he think he is talking about his right to wear his hair like a beehive in the Mr. Olympia and then complaining that he should have won? Where'd he say that, Leroy? You're asking me? You wrote the interview on Muscle Builder. No, sir. What Robbie insists on is wearing his hair as he pleases, and you have to admit that he has the right to do so, but... So why does he complain, then, the judges find fault with his afro? Have you seen Arnold with his hair down to his waist? Why are you so concerned with his hair length? Because Robbie cried after the contest. He called for more black judges, as if other blacks would be better appreciate his idea of grooming. Man, I'm black, and I'll tell you that all the blacks I've talked with considered Robbie's post-Olympia statements embarrassing. Why don't you tell the guy to cut that hair down? This is America, not Africa. Well, the guy has the right to choose his hairstyle. And we have the right to judge as we see it. If he wants to do his thing in the Olympia, then he better be prepared to stand the consequences. There was no stopping either of us. But then some of the ladies present insisted that it was time to head for bed. I left George and Margaret Snyder with Mr. and Mrs. Colbert in the Sheridan foyer to talk with Joe Valdez and Elaine Robinson near one of the hotel's elevators. And that was when I first heard about what happened with Robbie. He collapsed, his wife informed me. We got Dr. Walczak, and he gave us some stuff for Robbie to take. He's in bed with 104-degree fever. Elaine was visibly disturbed, as was Valdez. We're trying to locate Walczak again, said Jim Mannion, secretary of the AAU Physique Committee, who had joined us in the elevator seconds before the door shut. After the doctor had been found, we all fitted into two cars and dashed off to a nearby Holiday Inn and Robbie. He was covered from chin to toe, arms folded across his chest. His wife tapped his shoulder and he opened his eyes. His eyeballs swirled around grotesquely. Now it was my turn to be afraid. Elaine fed him some tablets that Walczak had prescribed. Hi, Rick, Robbie said weakly. How you doing, my man? He grunted something indecipherable. Look, Robbie, I said, the contest is important, but really, you are bigger than any award. Bigger and more important than the cash prize. Remember that. Don't go putting more pressure on yourself by imagining you're going to be let a whole lot of people down if you bow out. Earlier on the plane over, Robbie had requested an oxygen tank from the stewardess and throughout most of the trip had breathed through an attached mask. At the time, he had told me this was normal procedure. He couldn't stand heights. But now I was wondering, is there something more seriously wrong with Robbie? His heart, maybe? Bodybuilding buzzed with stories about the condition of Robbie's heart. He opened his eyes long enough to say, thanks, Rick. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your concern. And then Mannion, Valdez, and I had left him to sleep. The pills he had earlier swallowed were sedatives, Elaine had told us. So, on with the show. One awoke early on the big day. Breakfast companions were Albert Busack of IFBB Germany, Bob Sweeney, a multi-gym owner from England, the Snyders and their daughter Lori, Ben and Joe Weider, Dennis Stallard and Oscar State, among other famous IFBB dignitaries. Contenders for the various titles hovered like agitated bats around tables or ate heartily, depending on which contest they were slated for. Since the Mr. Olympia was scheduled to begin around 2:30 in the afternoon, combatants were taking advantage of a good, well, good as this hotel offered, meal. There would be no time to eat until after their show ended. Late. I bumped into Bill Grant on my way to the Sheridan. He and Kathy had apparently got out of bed minutes earlier. I had to wake him, said the young woman, wide-eyed. Every seat at the Veterans Memorial was filled, all 4,000 of them, by 9 o'clock that morning. Amazingly, one had no pass and no ticket, and so the door people would not let me in, no matter that I talked about Muscle Builder all the while. Wonderful to tell, good sense prevailed, and a security man, whose name I'm ashamed to admit eludes me at this time, came to my rescue, equipped me with a press pass and tickets for two friends. Let me say now that regardless of what problems others may have encountered in the form of Jim Lorimer, I can say only that he was the perfect gentleman to me, took care of every little need, well, nearly all, that I had, even down to party tickets. Backstage was choreographed chaos. It seemed impossible that everyone there knew exactly what was expected of him, and yet everything went like clockwork. Arnold pranced around with earphones stuck to his face, communicated with a similarly attired number of people all over the theater. Others kept things moving, ordering edgy bodybuilders into lineups, making rooms available, even helping out with oiling up here and there. And then Bill Grant accosted Schwarzenegger. What about my ticket and hotel reservations, et cetera, went Bill. You know the rest. So far, Grant had encountered Oscar State, main judge of his contest, Lorimer and Schwarzenegger, promoters of the affair that he hoped to win. Funny how a line by deceased Janis Joplin springs to mind. Freedom is another word for nothing left to lose. Certainly, Bill was taking liberties here, there, and everywhere, and you could not help wondering where he learned his brand of public relations. But that's life, as they say. The Mr. International contenders were first to appear on stage for a scrutiny by the judges and as an excuse for 4,000 and more fans to behave hysterically. But let us deal with the judging panel. There had been all kinds of talk, threats in some cases, regarding the composition of this judging panel. At first, Ken Sprague and Jim Mannion of the AAU had been talked about as members. Then one heard Sprague had dropped out voluntarily. On the evening before the contest, however, in Columbus, there had been much ado about who would make up the International Olympia panels. For some reason that one still has not fully understood, Jim Mannion wanted 9 judges, while Oscar State, who deals with such affairs, wanted only 7. Before the night was out, Mannion assured me there would be 9 judges. He had apparently been replaced, he and Sprague, by 2 other AAU representatives. It would be said later that of the 2, only 1 held an official AAU judging card. But these are small matters that cause headaches to small people. Others on the 7-man panel included Larry Scott, who received a standing ovation for accepting Arnold's invitation to judge, Jacques Blumhardt, Albert Busack, Leroy Colbert, and Winston Roberts. The lightweights came on first. Carlos Rodriguez flashed clear signs of danger, and he received loud and prolonged applause. He had improved tremendously since his Gold Classic appearance a few weeks earlier. His confidence shone through his eyes like hypnotic vibrations. John Burkholder had plans of his own, which did not quite coincide with what Rodriguez had in mind for himself. He was big and cut, though a little pale next to the bronze Mr. USA winner. He posed with great finesse. Tony Pandolfo was also very impressive. In the middleweight division, Sammy Willis, Andreas Colling, Frank Colta, Doug Beaver, Erwin Note all shone with promise. It was clear that Samir Banute stood out and would chase Roger Kellard all the way to the number one spot in this class. The heavyweight division boosted Ray Mensur, Don Peters, Ben Herter, and Joe Nazario. It seemed to me the class winner would come from this named 4. Nazario had made incredible improvements since I last saw him in May in New York. His upper body definition in particular was conspicuous. Peters seemed confident. Weeks earlier, he had dropped a decision in the over 40 Mr. America to Earl Menard, former Mr. Universe. George Payne was also impressive among the heavies. Judges for the Mr. International were Paul Graham from Australia, Sven Thorsen from Denmark, C. Kaiser from South Africa, Jacques Blumhardt from Belgium, Bob Sweeney from England, Leroy Colbert from the USA, and Larry Scott. At the end of this feature, the scoring sheet will indicate how each judge saw the affair. Never mind that I disagreed in at least one instance with the final result. At one point, a lady with an ABC sports badge pinned to her blouse turned to me in the press box to ask, "Does it hurt? I mean, when they tense up like that?" I said, "No, at least it shouldn't." "So why the funny faces?" "Pure ecstasy," I assured her. "What about butts? Do they count too?" "Well, it all depends on who's judging," I said. "Oh, I just love butts," she said, as she clicked merrily away with her motorized $1,000-plus camera. At last, the final round of the Mr. International ended, and though it was well past 2 o'clock, the fans seemed ready for more. When Oscar State said there would be a short intermission before the prejudging of the Mr. Olympia event, there were boos. Weak, hungry ones, mind you, but boos nonetheless. The Big O, at last. Frank Zane came on first, with number 1 pinned to his wine-colored trunks. I'd heard the stories. Zane was a bit bigger this year. And like many others, I expected him to show up at the Olympia soft and pudgy. Zane can't hold weight, we had all come to believe that over the years. But there he was now, not huge, mind you, but definitely bigger, in the calves, the arms, and shoulders particularly. The man stood there as if he owned the place, monarch of all he saw, and the fans gave him more reason to feel confident. They applauded even as he stood there by himself, relaxed. In a way, Zane reminds me of Serge Dubré. When Dubré is standing there in his art form, relaxed posture, there is none who can hold a candle to him. He seems symmetrical, huge, cut, and confident. His waist is minuscule, and you fail to notice the lack of thigh density and shape, the weak lower legs. He positions himself so that his faults are no longer faults. pity that there comes a time when he has to shift himself on the orders of judges who insist on mandatory poses. As I say, in his relaxed stance, Zane looked unbeatable. But one wondered what would happen when the other guys came up to stand next to him when the time came for comparisons. Well, on they came, Corny, Padilla, Grant, McAway, to be outclassed by this vision of physical perfection called Zane. Mike Mentzer was in the press box with me, Mike, who adores massive muscle as I do, and he too had to admit Frank was out and away leading this under 200-pound pack. True, Ed Corny had improved over his New York showing, but for this reporter, he stood no chance against Frank Zane. When it came to mandatory posing, an area not at all designed to make Zane look good, the Fox held his own nonetheless. Hey, he even hit a side chest pose according to regulations. His thighs made other in the class appear smooth and shapeless. And while his calves were not necessarily the largest in the show here, they somehow remained impressive. Frank Zane has mastered the art of showing his body to best advantage, and that, more than anything else, is the key to his amazing success in the field. He would tell me later that his wife Christine helps him monitor his physique with the pictures that she takes of him towards the end of his Olympia preparations. By her pictures, I can see exactly which areas are lagging behind, which ones need special attention to show up the way I want them to, is how Zane put it to me recently. Danny Padilla was fat. I hate to say it, but it's the only truth there is. He was not nearly in competition shape, let alone Mr. Olympia condition. His smile and those appealing puppy dog eyes helped, but Bill Grant was in great form at the Gold's Classic. I've said elsewhere that he deserved better than he got there. But at the Olympia, his girlfriend's ecstasy notwithstanding, he was strictly food for the bird, so to speak. He's adopted a new thing. He walks on stage and flashes his audience a what's going on with you look, so much as to say, don't sit on your hands when I wander on. You're supposed to applaud such perfection. But my God, so embarrassing for most of us, especially those of us with a skin hue similar to Bill's. Grant simply hates criticism, but I'll say my piece regardless. His consistency is becoming a bore. He should take his appearance more seriously. And if he can't make the Olympia in better shape next time, then hell, call it a day, William, for your own sake. A few fans were having the time of their lives shouting, it's your year, Billy, show them the calves. But not only Bill's calves were lacking, he was not his usual ripped self. His triceps, as anyone noticed, are much too small for his amazing biceps. His back was not nearly ready for display this time out. Not even his thighs, which are usually cut, were in form at the Olympia. Now, here's hoping Bill will act like Frank Zane says he did and take note of this criticism. It's not meant to belittle him. He's been a good champion. But the Mr. Olympia is something else again. Ed Corny broke the house up with his posing, and somehow one kept thinking that perhaps Ed is mixed up about these ovations he receives at every showing. Posing will never win the title for you, Ed. You gotta firm up that lower midsection for a start. So then we come to the other class. Ko was magnificent. He was big, cut, and professional, and he posed with the class of Zane. Even his back, which has not normally impressed me, never mind that beautiful three-quarters kneeling shot, looked fine. The abdominals were still lacking, but you couldn't say the man's waist was anywhere near fat. Perhaps his abs suffer the same problem as Grant's calves. Callender was massive and for the most part cut. His back is still incredible, among the best ever witnessed at any muscle contest. But Callender is not put together in any way that reminds of the best Greek sculpture. Someone hurriedly put together a whole heap of slabs. That's the impression you get. Defined and eye-boggling slabs, mind you, but no great work of art. I say this so that others might know why judges sometimes are not impressed to any large degree by sheer mass. Roy's posing will have to take some more work from the great Caruso. Then we come to my main man, Robbie Robinson. I had not expected him to show up after his illness the night before, but there he was in the flesh. I have to say, I saw Robbie 3 weeks or so before the Olympia, and again, he seemed ready in advance. In July, when he won the World Cup, I thought he had lost some of the edge that in New York prompted me to write, he was a Zane with muscle. Oh, I know he beat out Padilla and Callender deservedly, but that incredible condition that he achieved for Wayne Davila's Night of the Champions had gone down the tube, so to speak. Well, to my eyes, Robbie was not at his best in Ohio either. For the first round of the contest, he applied too little oil, which tended to flatten rather than highlight his musculature. He put on more oil for later rounds, but then it seemed to me that his waist was bloated, even though he wasn't at all fat. He would tell me later that a quantity of sherbet he consumed earlier may have brought on the bloated effect. I believe whatever ailed Robbie the night before took a heavy chunk off his sharpness. The man was with us physically, but it seemed his spirit had disappeared. Never mind the manufactured enthusiasm displayed on the stage. Robbie is a very private individual, and you can never be certain what's really ticking inside him. Who can say for certain how long he'd been ill or how many times he dragged himself into bed, aching and with fever? Roger Walker came all the way from Australia and looked impressive even among the best men in the world. One wondered how he might have fared with, say, 5 weeks of specialized training under the trainer of champions. He is Australia's best, and Muscle Builder magazine cornered him for some exclusive interviews after the contest. Albert Beckles knew that he was in poor shape. He said he'd return to win in maybe a year. Ah, well. Dennis Tenorino impressed me in New York, Night of the Champions. At the Olympia, he was far better than he'd been in May. On the way to Ohio, he promised me a surprise, and he kept his word. Obviously, he prepared hard and long for this one. He smiled with confidence. His posing was good, and he was superbly tanned. The rounds went on, and still it seemed to me that the title would be fought between Zane and Ko. I thought Ko had most of what Zane showed, save maybe for a little symmetry, which, let's face it, is Zane's forte. The results would prove surprising. Cal Skalick had told me earlier that the 230 pounds body weight story had been exaggerated, but he assured me he was ripped all over. He came onto the stage beautifully arrogant, as if he did not belong among this riffraff lot. You wanted to root for Cal, but something you didn't quite comprehend held you back. Perhaps one was being unconsciously affected by the man's publicity. All that stuff about never having tasted defeat before, the business and Nimes, his reputed impatience with writers, that sort of thing. It all makes you wonder, in retrospect, how much judges might be affected by what they read and hear about the stars of bodybuilding. Judges are human, aren't they? I would have thought I was above it, but the Olympia has more than a little to do with the man's public image, and Cal's image, warranted or not, is not the best. Here's hoping he can change things by the next Olympia time. For truly, under all that arrogance, is a really beautiful guy. One tends to think Cal has been too trusting of heartless friends, and he's been used to stir troubled waters to hurricane proportions. But enough of that. He did not look anything like 230 pounds. Indeed, Zane would swear later that he saw Cal being weighed by Oscar State, and the scale showed a mere 210 pounds. But that weight was all muscle. The trouble with Cal, first his thighs and calves, though vastly improved over past showings, still are not up to the phenomenal arms and chest. His back is fantastically muscled, and Cal shows it to best advantage with the double bicep pose. But when it comes to spreading the darn thing, he's as bad as I used to be in my early years of competition, as bad as Nubray is at showing his lats. I have no doubt Cal will straighten this problem out in time, and when he does, look out, everybody. But he was ripped. One suspects he did not try too hard during the prejudging, and that belief would receive support later on. It remains to say that the night show went on without a hitch. The Olympia is a beautifully choreographed affair, and Arnold, Lorimer, and the others concerned have every reason to be proud. We had Len Boslin in his position, occupied by Reg Park last year. Len was efficient. A skit with Joe Weider and the Mr. International competitors was well performed, well received. The lighting was spot on, for which Arnold gave due praise for his talented stage manager. Indeed, at one point in the night show, Arnold came on to say that his relationship with Joe and Ben Weider, the IFBB 2, contrary to rumor, was wonderful. He said he sometimes disagreed with things, but it did not in any way meant he was not a strong supporter of the IFBB and the Weiders. He looked forward to working with them for a long time to come, he assured the packed crowd. Well, now it was results time. Joe Nazario pulled off his biggest victory to date by clinching the Mr. International overall title and a class win. Roger Callart surprised the hell out of the audience with his class win, and I have to say Roger was lucky. Carlos Rodriguez took the lightweight class, beating out Lebanese Samir Benoot. Don Peters was overall third. It would be a night full of surprises. In sixth place at Oscar State at the winding down of the Olympia ceremony, Danny Padilla.
The giant killer looked anything but aggressive as he came on to accept his share of audience applause and a check. In fact, Annie looked downright grateful, understandably. In fifth place, the master of ceremonies continued, Cal Scalak. There were boos, there were screams, and there were laughs. Cal came to the podium, a look of surprise plastered on his visage. Then he flung his arms out, lowered his head, crossed his legs, like Christ crucified. It was certainly an original reaction at best. Then he recovered to bring the house down with some dynamite-looking poses that should have been better presented during the prejudging. He left the stage finally, definitely a winner with an audience who'd obviously heard all kinds of stories regarding Cal's short bodybuilding career, some true, some untrue, all controversial. Boyer Coe took his fourth place win nicely. That is to say, there was no great pouring out of venom or anything like that, but it was clear the decision was not all that popular. There were boos here too. Roy Callender's third placing brought hardly any audience reaction. But then, as State took his time announcing the second place winner, Robbie turned around, grabbed Frank Zane around the waist, lifted him clear off the platform in a congratulatory hug. He would tell me later that he had said to Frank at the time, "Congratulations, you've done it again." And Frank was voted Mr. Olympia 1978 with Robbie in second place, perhaps the luckiest man on show that night. It matters not that Dennis Tenorito was not among the winners. Neither was Tony Emmett, who I neglected to mention earlier, but will now. He was in great shape and, to my mind, deserved at least fourth spot. It was a truly enjoyable Mr. Olympia, one that deserves far more space than is available here. In fact, there remains so much more to tell, I'll have to use up a number of issues to tell half of what you should know about the 1978 Mr. Olympia. But finally, the whole thing will appear, amazing pictures and all, in my Body Men Part 2. Be sure not to miss it. Moreover, I have wonderful interviews with Frank Zane and Robinson and Co., most of the Mr. Olympia contenders, the winners and losers. Zane would say before the night was out that he thanked me for my derogatory remarks following the 1977 Olympia. They made me train all the harder, he said in good spirit. At a post-Olympia party, he told everyone how Joe Weider helped him with his posing and in directing the last part of his Mr. Olympia preparations. Details later. What did Robbie say? He replied to Leroy Colbert's article at last, but you'll have to wait for that. And there's Billy Grant, who'll probably never talk to me again, if indeed he is more foolish than I imagine. But best of all is the interview I got from Arnold. Check me later, mister. All right. Great article by Rick Wayne. He did get a couple things wrong. Boyer Coe was in the under 200-pound class, not the over 200-pound class. And Samir got second to Roger Callard, not to Carlos Rodriguez. So there were a couple of mistakes in that. All right. And then there was a short article here written by Rick Wayne called As the Judges Saw It. And they have the full score sheet for the under 200 and over 200-pound class. So I'll read this real quick. It says, here are the International Olympia results. They were forwarded to me by Oscar State a day or so after the contest. In a cover letter to me, State says, I think you'll agree that this is proof of the superiority of the IFBB point system, because one can derive so much more information from it than from the placing system, which merely provides a bald, uninformative, and limited line of figures from first to sixth and nothing else. I would like to make a few comments on some of the more outstanding facts of the score sheets. The Mr. International results were fairly straightforward, but Carlos Rodriguez deserves special mention for being the first bodybuilder ever to obtain the maximum 300 points since our point system was revised last year. Even so, when he competed against Joe Nazario in the pose down, a good big man once again beat the good little man. The Mr. Olympia was full of interest disclosures. Frank Zane was a clear winner in the 200-pound class, and he scored 100 for his posing routine. Only one judge failed to score him as first, Leroy Colbert, who preferred Boyer Coe. Ed Corney and Danny Padilla tied for the third spot, but the higher placing in the pose down put Danny just ahead of Corney. Ed's posing this time was below the usual standard, and one judge only, Jacques Blumhardt, gave him 20 points. The rest chose Zane. The over 200-pound class is also very revealing, and as Bill Drake told me, in some ways dynamite. Only four judges placed Robbie first. One judge had him equal with Callender, and two judges, Blumhardt and Bill Pearl, had Callender first.
Of course, Callender's improvement is indicated by the closeness of this point total. At the World Cup in Los Angeles, he was 13 points behind Robinson. This time, he was only 4 points behind Robbie. Perhaps Robbie had deteriorated. Cal Scalak was ranked third by all seven judges. So much for the cries of fix, if any. It was an overwhelming majority decision, which included two professionals, Pearl and Colbert. As a consequence, Cal finished 10 points lower than Callender, and when confronted by the bodybuilders from the lighter class in the pose down, Zane and Co. easily outscored him. So his fifth spot was both logical and inevitable. Further hard facts of the pose down, three judges placed Cal in sixth place. Zane and Robinson had three first place votes in the pose down, but Zane had another 3 second places to only one for Robinson, which is why Zane was the ultimate winner. The only other man to be voted first, as I've said, was Co, whom Leroy continued to favor. So here is one fair-minded black judge who did not allow color to sway his decision. Did you actually say fair-minded, Oscar? Tony Emmett had some good points going for him in the pose down, and had he scored just 3 points more in the prejudging, he would have finished in the money in sixth place. Finally, I hope that the bodybuilders will enjoy this commentary and the results as handed down by the judges. The IFBB has nothing to hide, obviously. All right, so that was some interesting comments by Oscar State, especially about the point system, which was criticized a lot after Arnold won the 80 Olympia. But he is right. It does offer more proof of what the judges think of each competitor than just giving them a one or a two or a three, although the point system is obviously much easier. And it was also interesting to note that Zane and Robbie tied with three places each. So that was a very close contest in 1978 between Frank Zane and Robbie Robinson. And it was only Zane getting 3 second places and Robbie only getting 1 second place, which made the difference. And of course, Cal, I was at this contest and Cal did look spectacular, but his legs were out of proportion. So I really wasn't surprised he got fifth place, but he did bring the house down. Him and I think Ed Corney and Frank Zane were probably the ones that brought the house down more than anybody. And also Boyer Coe. Boyer was always fantastic during his posing routine. So that was a very interesting article by Rick Wayne. Boy, he was not afraid to criticize people. I don't think Rick Wayne would last in today's society where people get so offended by everything. But his writing was very, very sharp. Very sharp tongue on Rick Wayne. And I hope one day we get a chance to interview him. That would be a great interview. I am definitely a fan of his work. All right, so that's it for the show this week, guys. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Mark Martinez. We will have part two next week, and we will have another article from another bodybuilding magazine. If you guys want to hear anything, just email me at naturalolympia.com. All right, stay safe out there with all the COVID. Enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.